Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin. You know, this is the time of year.
Yes.
When people like us begin to take stock and think about our year in listening. Think about the albums and statements and shows that stood out to us. It also happens to be, we're days away from Thanksgiving.
And we have an attitude for gratitude.
We certainly do.
There's a lot of things that we are grateful for and a lot of things that we'll be digging into. Lots of food, that is. And speaking of dig, don't forget our wonderful This I Dig coming up after the interview with Jonathan Blake.
What's it going to be? Stick around to find out. I think I speak for both of us. We're grateful to be close to this music and to do that for a living.
And I am absolutely grateful to the support of WRTI and the community of supporters who give financially to keep The Late Set going and WRTI and all of the great things we do in support of music and in support of specifically Philadelphia musicians.
Mm, yes, you know who you are. Thank you for your support. And if you are not among that number, we hope you'll join that number.
WRTI.org.
Please do. Now, our last episode featured a brilliant guitarist and composer, Mary Halvorsen. She put out what is one of my favorite albums of 2025. And today we have an episode with Philadelphia's own drummer, composer, bandleader, Jonathan Blake, who I think put out one of your favorite albums of 2025.
It's really great. It's called My Life Matters. And I have to be honest, though, it's not the easiest record to play on the radio because it has sort of an epic sweep to it and lots of tunes running into the next tune in sequence. So it's difficult to play on the radio, although I have, and I do so excitedly because I just think it's a beautiful recording. It's a real statement from Jonathan, and he's got some great musicians, Fabian Almazan and Dana Stevens and some other young sluggers on there.
Yeah. Now, this album was, you know, you mentioned the totality of it. This was composed as a suite for the Jazz Gallery way back in 2017.
Right.
And so this is a programmatic piece of music that he has been, you know, it had its premiere then. It has since been kind of refined a bit. And I'm really glad that it has now seen release on Blue Note Records. This has been a really heavy year for Jonathan Blake on the record and out in the world. We'll talk a little more about that maybe after the interview, but I just want to note that he appears on several really great albums this year. There's this one, of course. There's also an album by Sumi Tonouka, Under the Surface, with the Alchemy Sound Project, which we've covered at WRTI. Jonathan is a featured guest on that album. And through the Jazz Gallery, once again, they have a mentoring series. And the Jazz Gallery mentoring series paired Jonathan up with a young pianist named Dabin Ryu. And she put out a trio record that he's on, which I also really, really liked. And so there's all of that. And
not to mention the guys on the road incessantly.
Incessantly. So this is, you know, one of the bands that he is a member of is Chris Davis's trio with Robert Hurst on bass. They actually just dropped a Tiny Desk concert. And I believe they have another album coming in the new year. But at the beginning of last year, you and I caught a gig at the Village Vanguard. This was maybe January, I don't know, 5th or 7th or something like
right
that.
Right around Winter Jazz Fest.
Yeah. And this was probably the first mind-blowing gig of the year for both of us.
It was really awesome.
And once again, you know, just Jonathan Blake holding it down and doing what he does. All this is to say that we have unlimited admiration for this man. He's a really special music maker, and I can't wait to hear the conversation you had with him here.
Right here at WRTI with Jonathan Blake on The Late Set.
Thank you.
Jonathan Blake is our guest here on The Late Set, and boy, just a tremendous legacy with that name, association alone, and the Blake family here in Philadelphia. Welcome back home, first of all, Jonathan.
Thank you, Josh. I appreciate it. It's great to be back home.
And here for a very specific purpose to talk about this recording, My Life Matters.
Yeah. First of all, I got to shout out your sneakers. I love these sneakers.
Oh, thanks, man. It's a killing. I'll just give you the quick story on them. So I ran the New York Marathon in 2015.
Oh.
Can you believe that?
Nice.
So I dedicated myself to being able to accomplish that. Tick it off the bucket list, basically.
There you go.
So I did all the training when I was in my early 40s, and in 2015, ran the New York Marathon.
Go ahead.
And as a favor to myself, decided to buy myself these super cool shoes that were available exclusively for New York City for the marathon, 26.2.
Killing.
And 10 years afterwards, I pulled them out of the closet because I had never touched them. And I said, I'm going to start wearing these.
These look good on you, man.
They
do, right? It's a nice fit. I like it.
Well, thank you very much.
Now we got to get you some Eagles gear and you'll be set.
I know. I got to get some Philly mural arts vibe
there
on
you
my
go.
Shoes.
Ah, mural arts. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, they, in writing this music, it, called for us to start thinking more as a complete people, like just really trying to look out for one another, you know, speaking up and speaking out when we see injustice. And I think now more than ever is this mantra, so to speak, that I'm trying to connect with people out there. I think it's more relevant than ever right now. So the title kind of goes back to something that my parents used to say to myself and my sisters were when we were growing up, was about, like, if you don't speak up and speak out when you see injustice happening, then you're just as much as the problem. So that kind of stuck with me. And when I was writing this music, you know, I was seeing a lot of brutality being directed towards Black and brown communities, Asian communities, and LGBTQ plus communities. So I thought, what better way to kind of address this than, you know, to speak through my music, and, you know, as some of my heroes and sheroes did before me, you know, Abby Lincoln, Nina Simone, John Coltrane, Charles Mingus,
Max Roach.
Yeah. You know, so that kind of stuck with me. And thinking about, like, at the end of the day, we all kind of want the same thing. We all, you know, want to live in harmony. We all want love. We all want food, shelter. So, but it's so much easier for people to notice the differences as opposed to noticing how similar we are. So, all these factors kind of came into focus when I was writing this music.
Before we speak further about My Life Matters, I want to take you back to a moment with you and your father. And it always used to be like, it wasn't a joke ever, you know, but it was always like, yeah, look at Jonathan Blake as a little kid. You are performing with your father, There Are Many Ways to Say I Love You.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a very special moment. I was still playing violin at the time, and I was 6 years old, so I was studying at the Settlement Music School here in Philadelphia, one of the branches here in Philly. And
were you learning Suzuki method or John Blake method?
I was studying Suzuki method, and then also taking some lessons with my father, some private lessons with my father. But mostly it was done through the Settlement Music School. I think they had a branch in Chestnut Hill and also in Germantown, so we were taking lessons there. But my father, you know, as you know, he was traveling all the time, and he had a gig in Pittsburgh. And the band, he was brought down as a special guest, like a guest soloist with a band. And the band was basically Mr. Rogers' band, on the house band on the Mr. Rogers show. So it was like Joe Negri on guitar, Johnny Acosta on piano, who was like a virtuoso pianist who, you know, was inspired by Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson, and he had, you know, tremendous chops. So I guess on that gig, my dad kind of pitched this idea, like, you know, I have a son who's 6 years old, and, you know, we watch Mr. Rogers every day. You know, that growing up, that in Philly, that was the, there were like three shows that went, that came on PBS back to back to back. So it was Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, and the Electric Company. So, you know, as a kid, especially on the weekends, that's what we grew up. We watched that every day. So, you know, I guess he pitched this idea about having us on the show. You know, he was saying, yeah, I have a son that plays violin and he's studying. And so Joe Negri pitched the idea to Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, and he jumped on it. So he flew the whole family down to Pittsburgh and we taped the show. He sent us a cassette to the house with, you know, maybe about five or six songs that we could choose from. And the one that we chose was There Are Many Ways to Say I Love You.
How many times do you have a lesson?
Once a week.
Once a week. Does your daddy ever help you with it?
Yes.
I bet he does. Would you like to play something with him and the other musicians?
Okay.
So that all five of you could play something together? That'd be fun for me to hear that if you would.
You surprised me with that one.
Well, you know, first of all, it's good to remember such a powerful show with great messages for kids. And also with the jazz influence.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to play some of this audio to maybe take you back to a moment, Jonathan, and maybe to fast forward to you right now, because, you know, you've got two now grown children. You know, you are not 6 years old by any stretch.
No.
And the sort of innocence that is sort of represented in your performance on that program and what is so beautiful and special about it, I think about what has happened in the gap that is your life,
right,
and your
right.
set of experiences that has gone from that to having to write a suite of music that says, my life matters. Where are we failing as a society?
Man, that's such a loaded question, but there's so many ways that we're failing. You know, I feel that number one, we're not caring for the older ones that have, you know, that this country was built on their backs. You know, I feel like prices of medication have gotten out of hand, you know, to where people are, you know, our older ones are having to choose between life and death, you know, like they, you know, and it's horrible. You know, how can you put a price on making people feel better? You don't get into those professions to like make money. You get in those professions, hopefully to cure and help people to feel better. And I feel like we've lost sight of that. You know, it's more about greed and having more. You know, you talked earlier about, I don't know, like that time, me growing up, there was such an innocence. You hit that word. It was such an innocence that, you know, it was like...
It wasn't perfect.
It wasn't
I'm
perfect by no
under
stretch.
That illusion.
But I don't know. I just feel like it was a sort of a better time. You know, I feel like we were more in tune with one another, really trying to look out for one another. The thing that kind of boggles my mind now is this is one of the richest countries, but, you know, I travel all around the world. You know, I go to these different places and I see how they take care of their older ones and things of this nature. People are, you know, they're able to live and not have to worry about, like, am I going to be able to afford my medication that I need to help me feel better? You know, just basic things that I feel that we've really lost sight of that.
Our guest is Jonathan Blake here on The Late Set. The new recording is My Life Matters. You've dedicated your entire life to this artistic pursuit. And like I said, to get to a point where you are using all this creative energy and talent that is within you and that you have cultivated over decades now, and pointing it kind of back at the country where it couldn't have been anywhere else that you could have been created. Right. You know?
Right. Well, and I also think now, you know, you mentioned, you know, as being a parent, I also, you know, that's what we want for our kids, you know, growing up. We want them to grow up and have that freedom and feel safe in these environments and, you know, and not worry about being shot down or, you know, whatever. You know, it's just so sickening to see, you know, or hear about people being taken away, you know, kids being taken away at this early, you know, at too early of a stage in their life due to gun violence. And, you know, it's just something simple, like, you know, try to have more gun reform or whatever so that kids can feel free to walk the streets without worrying for their safety. You know, and as a parent, you know, for me, I feel like it's not natural to have to worry about things like that, or it shouldn't be natural, or we shouldn't have to worry about things like that. But at the same time, as a father, you know, I wanted to be an example for my kids. You know, I wanted to see me speak up and speak out when I see things that are not right. You know, I didn't want them to see
acquiescence.
Or a person that just hides in the shadow of danger or whatever. So, you know, my kids are now 20 and 18, and they really have good heads on their shoulders. So I'm really proud of the people that they are becoming. And I feel that is a testament to their mother, Rio Sakahiri, who runs the Jazz Gallery, and myself, just me, you know, trying to be those people that they look up to.
Yeah. The Jazz Gallery commissioned the music that is My Life Matters. You talk about that fellowship grant and kind of how you started to focus on this particular work.
Sure. So I was awarded this fellowship grant for, I think it was 2017 or 2018. And this is a grant that the Jazz Gallery offers for kind of mid-career artists. And the award and the grant comes with being able to stay at this home in Tarrytown at the Rockefeller Brothers estate. And they basically can stay there for up to maybe 2 weeks. And you're just left alone to write music. And so that's what I did. I drove up to Tarrytown for about 2 weeks, had my keyboard, had my drums. And
man, do you stay anywhere for 2 weeks?
No, I haven't done that in ages, you know, barely my own place. So to have that luxury was just an amazing experience, you know, and you're just really secluded. You know, you're just, you know, there's a person that stays on the grounds, but they don't bother you at all. They kind of show you around and then take you shopping. You get, you know, you get like a spending allowance, you buy food, and then they just let you go. So I was kind of just put there by myself, and I had to get used to it being that quiet. You know, I haven't been in a situation where it's like nothing. Like I started talking to squirrels or something, but it was just super quiet. But it was an amazing experience because so many times I feel like, you know, I'll start an idea and then I'll get interrupted and I have to like forget about it and do whatever has to be done at that time. So this was really interesting for me to be able to like kind of start ideas and see them all the way through. So at the end of the 2 weeks, I had the majority of the music completed. And then I came back home and maybe kind of fine-tuned some things and maybe changed a few forms around and things of that nature. And then there was the premiere maybe a couple weeks later. Now, when writing the music, I kind of always envision who, you know, I want in the band, you know, who can kind of like take what's on the paper and kind of use that as a blueprint and then take it and run with it. So I think originally I had Rashawn Carter playing bass, Fabian Amazon playing piano and kind of like some electronics, Dana Stevens playing tenor and iwi and soprano, and Joel Ross was playing vibraphone on the original. Now, I knew I wanted that sound, and those were the members that I, you know, that I was using. And then it kind of switched a little bit. I started playing more with Desron Douglas. So Desron came in on bass, and then this young, amazing vibraphonist from Houston, Jalen Baker, came in. And that became the core band. And, wrote with them in mind. And, they kind of exceeded my wildest dreams. Like, they took the music and just took it to different places, and that's what you can, you know, that's what you always hope for, that will happen when you put a band together.
Let's hear a little bit of the title selection to Jonathan Blake's recording, My Life Matters, here on The Late Set. That's My Life Matters.
Yes, yes.
Jonathan Blake here on The Late Set. From the recording, My Life Matters.
Yeah, the title track.
Man, what an interesting sound, you know? Like, it's definitely modern music, but it's also got sort of some antecedents in the 1970s.
Oh, totally. There's definitely, you know, I feel like as a composer and as a player, you write from your influences. So I'm inspired by music from the 70s. I'm inspired by, you know, the R&B and funk bands from the 70s, you know, of course, EWF, you know, George Clinton.
Sure.
You know, so Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, Jackson 5. So, you know, and a lot of that music was played in my house, you know, growing up. My father had a studio built in the basement of our house in Philly. And first of all, that's where I was regulated to when I was playing drums, of course. But he also had his record collection there. So a lot of times I would come home from school and just go down. And he had the setup was like he had these amazing speakers downstairs, but he also had speakers upstairs, you know.
Zoned listening.
Yeah. So, you know, when I really wanted to drive my mom crazy, I would set it so that they would flow throughout the house.
Nice.
And just blasting music. But, you know, but he had such an avid collection, you know. It was anything from Duke Ellington to Parliament Funkadelic, you know. So it was just, you know, it was a very eclectic collection of music.
Is that where you heard We Insist?
Oh yeah, I heard that very early. Yeah, I heard that very early on. He had that record, so I heard that very early on because I was also a Max Roach freak when I started playing the drums. You know, I think my two biggest heroes and influence were Max and Elvin. He had Love Supreme, of course, and then sure. He had We Incest, and then he also had, of course, like Kind of Blues. So the other one was Nefertiti. He had, so I was hearing Tony, Jimmy Cobb, and Max and Elvin. So those were kind of my early influences.
That's some serious imprints, yeah. Right there.
So it was kind of, for me, like it was kind of almost like an escape, you know, because you can kind of feel like an outsider, you know, coming up and you know, public high school, and everybody's talking about Dr. Dre, and you know, and I'm talking about Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. They're like, who? So this was kind of like, you know, an escape in a way, just kind of going down there and just being in my own element and exploring and checking out records. And my father was definitely hands-on, but you know, he also allowed me to explore and figure out things for myself too. So, you know, a lot of times if he wasn't home, then I would just pull out whatever and, you know, pull out whatever record I found and, you know, read the liner notes. That's what was so great about vinyl, is like, you know, you're looking at these liner notes and you kind of feel like you're, you know, either in the, you know, in the presence there.
You are physically connected.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah. So it was an amazing experience to be there. And that definitely had a lasting impact on my composing, you know, me as a composer. And of course, also my father, you know, he was a prolific composer. So I grew up with a lot of his music.
I have all of his Grammavision recordings.
Oh yeah, those are the classics.
I think it's the tragedy of the commons that a lot of that stuff is not available.
I know. I just started seeing, I think there's three or four out of the five records he might've done for Grammavision. I think they finally got on Apple Music, but The Twinkling of an Eye, Adventures of the Heart, and New Beginning. So the very first one called Maiden Dance, that's the one that's not on there yet. So yeah, so three out of the four, I should say. And then the acoustic record he did, Quest, for Sunnyside, that's up there too, which is great. But yeah, I mean, those are some classic records. So those were in heavy rotation as I was coming up.
When I find them in the record store, I buy them even though I have copies.
Oh, really?
So that I can give them to other people, just because it qualifies as what I call cheap heat.
Yeah,
you know, love that. Like for the cost of getting some of those records.
Yeah.
And the value you get in listening.
Oh, totally. I've gotten my son into crate digging now, so okay. You know, we've been down to Princeton to the Princeton Record Exchange, sure. And so. He's the same thing. Like, he was thumbing through thing, and he found a record of my dad's, and he was like, oh, I got to get this one. This is Pop Pop on here. I was like, yep, pick it up. So he got it, and, you know, so it's, you know, so it's nice to see that we kind of share that common, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess that common thing together.
That thread.
So, yeah,
that
common thread. So.
Well, you know, speaking of common thread, both of your children, Jana and Muna, are both on this recording.
They are.
In two different pieces. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that?
Yeah, this was very special. I mean, first of all, this record is such a personal expression for me, you know, because it deals with a, you know, sensitive subject that's very near and dear to my heart in, you know, something in, you know, and making this music, it was hopefully a way to kind of start to have those uncomfortable conversations that we need to have to spark any kind of change. But it was so special to have them on this recording with me. My daughter recites a poem that her mother actually wrote, that Rio actually wrote for this recording. She had this poem, and when she heard the music early on, I remember Rio saying to me, she was like, I have this poem that I think works perfectly with this suite of music. And I think Muna would be amazing to have her recite it. So I remember when we premiered it at the gallery, that was a hit, man. People love seeing her get up there and recite this poem. So when, of course, when we went in to record, I had to have her on it. And she knocked it out of the park again.
I want to be needed. I want to matter. I want to laugh and be happy. Don't you? Let's be. Let me. Let you. Because, I mean, where do we go from here? What other choices do we have?
So that was very special, you know, it's a very special moment on the recording because it's all pared down. It's just basically her and Desron playing behind her. So it's just very, very raw and very naked, but it's just a beautiful moment in the recording. And then towards the end of the record, there's a piece called We'll Never Know. They never even get to try, you know, meaning that these young people are taken away from us before they even get to show who they're going to be or what they're going to be.
It's such a soulful tune.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a beautiful melody.
Like down home blues.
It's totally, you know, yes.
Yeah. So Dash Ron said, man, we have to have Jonah on this part. So behind Dash Ron's solo, Dash Ron takes a solo on that particular piece. And Jonah is kind of hanging, laying down the bass line behind him. And then there's one brief moment right at the end of the piece where he has a two bar solo or something. And it was just this beautiful moment. And I remember, oddly enough, part of the recording, I had to leave early because I was playing that whole week at the Vanguard. You know, we recorded last December. So I was playing at the Vanguard with Kenny Barron. He does an annual 2-week residency at the Vanguard. So part of the recording, I had to just lay down my tracks, and I was like, okay, I got to go. I got to make the set at the Vanguard. You know, but Derek Hodge, who produced the record, knew exactly the vision I was going for. So, you know, he talked about this moment. He's like, man, this was such a beautiful moment because he was witnessing Desron showing Jonah what to play or how to phrase this. And it was just this beautiful moment that...
That's it. That's
yeah,
the music.
That's the music, yeah.
That's it, right?
Yeah. There. You know, we talk about that. You know, we talk about this mentorship and apprenticeship, and that moment was what it was. And I remember when we were going to mix the record, Derek was like, you weren't there, but this was a special moment of, you know, passing down, you know, this tradition. And, you know, this is a really important part that needs to be focused on in the music, you know, on this record. So I'm glad we kept that in there because it's a beautiful moment, even though it's brief, but it's just a really special moment, you know, that teacher and student relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Hodge does a wonderful job working with you and helping you sort of craft that vision. I think also the layer of Jahi Sundance,
yeah,
who is the son of Oliver Lake, a great musician. It just creates this sort of sweeping sound.
It does. It does. You know, it was really special. This felt like a family affair, you know, like...
They go over the bar from track to track.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, you know, that was deliberate. Like, I really wanted that sweet, you know, because the whole idea is, like, I really want people to listen to it as a whole, you know, not, you know, individual tracks. You know, it has to be kind of put together. So that's kind of why I had it like that. You know, the record starts out with just Jahi and I kind of, like, you know... You'll hear like themes like, oh man, we just got pulled over for Bust a Tail Light, you know, that was, you know, taken from the murder of Orlando Castillo. So that was Diamond saying, all we did was get pulled over for Bust a Tail Light, and now my husband is gone. You know, so then that's going underneath my solo. But the thing that I love about Jahi, he's, you know, when I met Jahi, we used to do a summer camp in Montclair. This was before Jazz House Kids. It was called JOY, Jazz Opportunities for Youth. And it was run by a great bassist by the name of Chris White. Jahi was playing.
Who used to play with Dizzy Gillespie.
Who used to play with Dizzy Gillespie.
And Nina Simone.
Exactly. Yeah. Jahi played baritone sax, you know, in the group. I knew him as a saxophone player. So now he brings that musical element to what he does. So he, you know, he just... You know, I kind of sent him the track, and he knew right away what to put in there, and it was just, yeah, it was just like the perfect combination. Yeah, I was so, you know, like I said, it was family. You know, I've known him since I was about 13 or 14 years old, and then Derek and I have known each other for, you know, over 20 years. And then another addition is having the great vocalist Bilal. Bilal and I grew up around the corner from each other in Philadelphia. So he would either walk to my house to rehearse or I would walk to his house to rehearse. So, you know, it's just...
Did you play each other your dad's records too?
Oh, yeah. He would come over and, you know, even if my dad would be there playing at the piano and Bilal would be singing. That was a normal thing, you know, that started early on. Like, you know, Christian McBride would come to my house when he was like 13 playing bass. He's like, Mr. Blake, you know this song, this Wayne Shorter song, you know? So it was just kind of like people were coming in and out early on, you know? So yeah, it for, you know, for them to come back and do this recording with me, it was really kind of like a homecoming in a way, like a family reunion.
I want to shift again to the focus of My Life Matters. You know, everything that we have talked about in this conversation, I feel has been just, in a lot of ways, very optimistic,
mm-hmm.
you know, despite sort of kind of the daily struggles. When I talk to a lot of other musicians, Jonathan, I hear we are trying to show everybody the way, but nobody wants to listen. Do you ever feel like a certain despondency about, because you're out there every night just about playing music with someone, leading the band or otherwise?
Right. Yeah, there's definitely that aspect where you kind of feel you're not connecting all the time with the listeners or, you know, or...
But just showing people a better way of living, of thinking... of representing, of listening, you know, some of these lessons that maybe we've lost since Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we, you know, there's still a way to connect with people.
How will always be the question.
Exactly.
How do we do this stuff?
Yeah, that's, you know, always going to be the challenge.
But what I worry about is, do we collectively, no matter where you are on these spectrums of thought, do you have the willingness to want a better thing?
Of course. Of course. I definitely want that. And I think to people who come out to hear us, they want that. You know, I think, you know, everybody in daily life wants that. You know, we want to, like I was saying earlier, I think a lot of us want the same thing. We want peace. We want harmony. We want, you know, we want food and clothes on our backs and a roof over our heads. You know, we all want the same thing. And it's unfortunate that, you know, there's such a disparity in, you know, in our country that, you know, the a lot of the basic things that we all want, we're not able to get, you know, and,
But the algorithm doesn't promote this kind of conversation that you and I are having.
No, no.
And fundamentally, you know, I care about the media obviously a lot since that is my profession.
Right, right.
You know, and so how society is mediated with information, these are the concerns that I have.
Exactly.
You know, whereas I know sometimes when you're on a stage and you're directly communicating your art and your music, those kind of things peel away.
They do. They do. And I think that's our job as artists. We're supposed to be the storytellers. We're supposed to take these people on a journey and get them to forget about their day-to-day life, you know, come in and just be in this moment with us for however long and walk out of there feeling, you know, much better or more on a more positive light, hopefully. You know, I can't count on my hands and toes how many times, you know, I've been approached from people after coming to a show, either that I'm leading or, you know, in a band, and like, man, this really took me somewhere else. You really uplifted me. And when I hear that, that means I've done my job. So I'm always happy when I, you know, when I get that response from people. And that, you know, because that is our job. You know, we're storytellers. We're supposed to take these people on a journey.
Well, I want to thank you for being such a great storyteller. And I feel like the response when people kind of have those moments as a result of engaging with music that you've created is just like there's an additional level of responsibility maybe that the audience has after that point. And that is to recognize that the person who brought you that emotional resonance inside of you, their life matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true.
Jonathan Blake, My Life Matters on Blue Note Records. Thank you for joining us on The Late Set.
Thank you for having me.
Josh's conversation with Jonathan Blake. Man, I keep missing these great hangs.
Well, you're too busy doing other fun things.
I do fun things, but I would have enjoyed spending some time with Jonathan, especially, I understand he set up a drum kit here and did some things.
Yes.
And it would have been nice to witness a little mini drum clinic.
We actually had some students who were visiting WRTI's J. Michael Harrison, and one of those students came in and made it a point to say thank you to Jonathan Blake while he was here, in terms of just the impact that Blake's music has on him, this young kid. I was super impressed by
that. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I know you were looking forward to this conversation. What takeaway do you have after digging in and talking about this, you know, fairly heavy topic? You know, what did you come away with?
I just come away with what a beautiful individual Jonathan Blake is. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's someone, it's great to hear him talk about some of growing up and the music that was on in the house and really caring about the ancestors, which includes his father, you know, great musician, John Blake, and also caring about the future, his kids appearing on the recording. You know, it really did feel like what Jonathan's very good at, you know, which is, I think, great for the holiday season as well, an attitude of gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a really, for someone so busy, he just keeps that sort of buoyant spirit about him.
Mm-hmm.
I was happy enough to get him. He was about to go on the road in Europe for over a month, and I just said, well, come home to Philly for a day and spend some time at WRTI, and we'll talk about this music.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, we didn't even mention it at the top of the show. I mentioned a couple albums he's on. But, you know, this is a guy who has been touring with the Maria Schneider Orchestra.
Kenny Barron.
Playing beautifully in a big band setting, playing with Kenny Barron, the master.
Yeah.
Sometimes with Kenny Barron and Dave Holland. I've seen him with Bill Frisell. His own band, Pentad, features players like Joel Ross and David Varelas.
Tom Harrell.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just goes on and on yeah. and on. He's become one of those people that just everybody wants because he's so selfless in serving the music. And his thing is so powerful and so precise and also so adaptable that he just makes everybody sound better.
He does. You want to sound better? You want your music to sound better? Add Jonathan Blake.
Yes, sir.
He made our podcast sound better.
He made our podcast sound better. He makes our broadcast sound better,
yes,
not infrequently. But maybe now it's time to cue up a segment we call This I Dig.
You go first because mine is stupid.
All right. I just changed mine up at the last second. Here at WRTI, we are deep in the process of assembling our holiday gift guide. And in fact, our next episode of The Late Set will feature the two of us digging into some of the musical bounty therein.
Look at this forward promotion. You're a pro.
I'm learning as I go. Hang tight for the gift guide and for all the musical gift ideas that we will be sharing. I'm going to toss in a little lanyap on the gift guide front. This is a non-musical gift, okay. But it's one inspired by a story that you just told me about a little mess in your kitchen. So earlier this year, for my birthday, I had a request. I said, you know what I want this year? I want a Mocha Master. Are you familiar with this?
I am not.
So for years and years, we had a Cuisinart drip coffee maker. Now, I love coffee. I care about it. it is a very important part of my productivity.
You should see his office on these days yeah. where he's pouring.
And yeah, so I brew. I'll do a pour over. I'll do a French press. I don't have an AeroPress, but that's another method that yeah. is nice. But you know, in terms of a day to day, like you gotta. You know, you got to get things moving. I need a good drip coffee maker. And for years, the Cuisinart was just fine. But I decided this year to upgrade. And I got to say, the Mocha Master is fantastic.
You have to be fantastic to live up to a name like that.
It is, yeah. It is Dutch, I believe. And it's a very, it's well known to, you know, coffee snobs. It's a little pricey, but it's a beautiful piece of machinery, and it does everything just perfectly. It doesn't have any bells and whistles. Like, it has no timer. It has no sound. Like, so there's no beep, beep, beep when it's done.
That's great.
It's got an on-off switch and a copper heating coil that delivers a very precise brew temperature. It will keep the coffee warm for quite a while before it starts to burn. So this was a problem with my Cuisinart previously is that, you know, you leave it on too long and eventually you're going to get, you know, some pretty gnarly, bitter, over-extracted flavors. So Josh, if you are in the market to upgrade your coffee game at home.
Become a Mocha Master.
This is my endorsement.
Quite nice. Well, I'm going to go into my usual thing of digging something that nobody else in the world cares about. Do you know what a Ford bullnose is, Nate?
A Ford bullnose?
Yeah.
Is this some, like, it's making me think of when the poet Marianne Moore was asked to come up with new names for an automobile.
That's hilarious.
Because bullnose is the kind, it's one of those words that she might have come up with.
So the bullnose is from a period of 1980 to 1986, Ford made pickup trucks where the front grille has a very distinctive slant, very similar to the way a bullnose cut would be on, say, a countertop.
Okay.
Know? So I say this because I am spending an inordinate amount of time right now learning about these trucks, because I am soon to be in possession of a 1985 Ford F-150 with a 4.9 liter, 300 cubic inch inline six cylinder, which is the tank of engines that Ford made for almost 40 years in cars and tractors even. I am spending a lot of time right now learning about this vehicle, learning about actually simple combustion in engines. And at some point, this is going to be another project like rebuilding a turntable where I'm just going to spend so much time and probably too much money and effort into doing something. But I
like
am
refurbishing?
Going to, I am going to refurbish this vehicle. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any function of the bullnose, or is it just a design element?
I think it's just a design element.
It's not aerodynamic in some way?
No, and it was just a terminology, I think, that was used at some point, because when they changed the design after 1986, they had more of a flat approach to the front end, and they called those brick noses.
Okay.
So, but the bullnoses are pretty highly prized, and I have to admit, you know, it captures a bit of my heart, because 1985, I was 11 years old, and I was in love with pickup trucks, and this was really like one of the trucks that I thought I'd have someday. Mm. And it turns out that
there you go.
In my 50s, here I am with a bullnose Ford pickup truck. And lots of YouTube videos later and Facebook groups out the wazoo related to these trucks and the particular engine that I mentioned. This is what I do when I'm not... Well, I sometimes do it while I'm listening to jazz.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this cues up a tangent.
Nobody digs this, by the way.
I think everybody digs it, but the bullnose and the Marianne Moore, I feel obliged to let you know that there is a very cool story behind this Marianne Moore car name thing, because Ford in 1955
yes.
commissioned her as a poet to come up with names for their next, you know, big vehicle. And some of the names that she came up with, I have to read them to you.
They certainly weren't the Crown Victoria, for sure.
She did not come up with the Crown Vic. Here are some names. Utopian Turtle Top.
Oh, very nice.
Resilient Bullet. Silver Sword. Anticipator. Mongoose Civic, Intelligent Whale. Now,
these sound like Sam Rivers titles.
They do. Ford Fabergé.
The Ford Luminous Monolith.
But here's the thing. They rejected all of her suggestions. And do you know what they ended up naming this vehicle?
What was it?
The Edsel.
The Edsel.
So that's
a little closer to home for
that's,
Henry
that's
Ford.
Kind of a, I think that's a fun little story of poetic vindication, because who knows, the Edsel might have had a different fate had it been named the Mongoose Civic.
This is true. Yeah, it's a far, far more elaborate name.
The late set, come for the jazz, stay for the arcana.
Yeah, it's like, it's like terrible card talk in addition to jazz.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. It's hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson. The show is produced by Alex Arif.
Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager, and he mixed this episode. Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Our production assistants are Alexander Bollacher, Tyler Deerfield, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran.
WRTI's Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson. Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philly and beyond. We'll see you next time when we dig into the Holiday Gift Guide.